From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as the city of Detroit seems to be on the brink of getting an emergency manager, the mayor of Flint thinks it's time to say farewell to theirs.
It's a good time to make the transition and have more community input and control.
Plus, he once voted against Michigan's Medical Marijuana Act, but a West Michigan lawmaker has had a change of heart. Now he hopes to clear the way for marijuana dispensaries.
As a chiropractor, and my father was a doctor, and my grandfather was a doctor, we take care of people. And I look at this as a healthcare delivery issue.
Plus, what's up with the anti-baby boom in Michigan?
Essentially, 79 out of 83 counties saw drops in terms of births. So we saw a pattern across the state that most counties saw drops, some very significant.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, medical marijuana dispensaries. We'll speak with a Republican lawmaker who wants local communities to be able to decide whether or not dispensaries should be allowed. And demographer Kurt Metzger has crunched some numbers, and he finds Michigan's in the middle of an anti-baby boom. We'll find out what this all means for us as a state. But first, the mayor of Flint says it's time to say goodbye to Flint's emergency manager and make Flint the first city in Michigan to have a transition team appointed under the new emergency manager law, a team to guide Flint back to being run by its mayor and city council. That was one of the key messages as Flint Mayor Dane Walling delivered his State of the City message last night, his fourth such address. Mayor Dane Walling joins us now from Flint. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Happy to be on.
Well, Flint, as we all know, has been in receivership since December 2011. Tell us, why do you feel now is the time to say goodbye to your emergency financial manager, Ed Kurtz?
Well, I believe it's time for a transition and for the city to take advantage of the new provisions that are in the new emergency manager law that's coming into effect later in March, because I want to see a smooth transition going forward. And there are a long list of long-term solutions that now need to be considered. Many of the short-term steps have been taken, and as decisions are being made that are going to affect the city for 10, 20, 30 years, in order for those to have credibility, they have to be made in a democratic fashion. So I think we can have the best of both worlds here. Continued accountability with a board in place while myself and city council, you know, get back to working on the day-to-day issues and leading the decisions on the city's long-term future.
What's your understanding as to just how would this transition board work with you as mayor and with the council?
Being the potentially first in the state, a lot of those questions would get answered, and the law provides some guidance, but there's a lot more than a page or two of law that would need to go into this. And the first thing is that a law requires for there to be a two-year budget put in place by the emergency manager before a board could be seated. So in Flint's case, there would need to be at least a few months of work that would go into getting ready for that transition to take place. And a number of tough decisions would continue to have to be made by the emergency manager with the state's approval. And then that transition advisory board would be in place. It would direct essentially the finance operations of the city, oversee those, look at monthly budget to actuals, cash flow statements, propose budget amendments that need to be taken up by the city council and myself. So that way we continue on a financially responsible path, but there wouldn't have to be a manager in place dealing with day-to-day operations and providing the guidance on strategy and long-term decisions.
You know, I don't need to tell you, Mayor Dane Walling, that Flint is still facing, you know, annual double-digit declines in tax revenue.
Yeah, that's right.
Millions of dollars in debt. EFM Ed Kurtz says, well, even though the city's budget is balanced for this year, next year's going to be even more difficult. So I'm just wondering, what would it take to keep history from repeating itself in Flint and falling back into the kind of trouble that got Flint an emergency manager in the first place? What's different?
That's exactly what the transition board is supposed to be put in place for, because when emergency financial manager Ed Kurtz was in place back in 2003, there was a hard cut, and it went from appointed emergency manager back to local control. There was no transition plan, and spending immediately started to escalate. That was a big reason why I ran for mayor in 2007 and 2009. So I want to be part of a solution. I want to be part of a process that's going to put a long-term structure in place for the city's financial solvency. And as I see it, as long as myself and city council are willing to affirm the two-year budget, the five-year deficit elimination plan, and work with a board to maintain the integrity of those efforts, then it's a good time to make the transition and have more community input and control.
So in essence, having this transition board is almost kind of like, if I may say so, almost like having training wheels as you're learning to ride that two-wheel bike.
And, you know, that's what I've said all along, that we want to welcome as much help on this as possible. And we've had Dr. Scorsone involved doing a long-term analysis before the state review board had come into place. I mean, we need to dig in and understand these challenges, but also recognize that there does need to be a democratic process. And in order for these solutions to really stick, we have to bring the community into the process. That's why I think this transition advisory board is an important interim step.
We're speaking with Flint's Mayor Dane Walling, who delivered his State of the City address last night and essentially calling on Governor Snyder to appoint a transition team under the new emergency manager law, a team that would guide Flint back to being run by its mayor and city council and say goodbye to the emergency financial manager. In your speech last night, you spelled out your top three priorities. The one we've been talking about, moving away from an EM's control, is one. Talk to us about your other two priorities.
Yeah, well, let's do them in order, because I specifically said our first is a long-term financial plan, and that's going to take the involvement of the emergency financial manager and the state. So once that gets in place, then I believe we'll become eligible for the transition advisory board. So that's the second step. And then the third is, by the end of the year, we need to have our long-term comprehensive master plan adopted that would guide our land use and our public investments around infrastructure and other programs for the next 20 to 30 years. And if we do those three things this year in 2013, then the city of Flint will actually be in a lot better position than it has for decades. We'll have a long-term plan, we'll have a board in place to assist with accountability, and we'll have a long-term vision for where we need to be putting our dollars so that we can be a more sustainable community in the future.
What has the process of being the mayor of Flint and having the city under the control of emergency manager, what has that meant to you personally?
Well, it has been a very challenging environment, and I believed I knew a lot about local government and government in general going into this job, but it has been an education to be in the middle of state laws and local laws and all the different levels of the courts. Not to draw the wrong comparison here, but, you know, we've all watched the president try to deal with federal debt negotiations and all the different factions and interests that are a part of those discussions. Being in this role during a time of an appointed manager is a lot the same. It's actually made the governing process more complicated, because now you have a local community and ordinances and a charter, and you have a state law, and you have all the different levels of courts that are weighing in on different decisions on a regular basis. Mm. So as a mayor, as a city council person, you're in the middle of all of that, and just trying to, you know, work for the betterment of the community.
Has having had an EM or an EFM, has that been good for Flint?
There have been a number of things that have gotten done that did need to get done. I am very kind of firm in my feeling on that point. Take the sanitation fee, for instance. That was something that I had discussed with city council members probably 2 years ago, and it didn't get a reception to the point where I didn't even want to bring it up as a resolution, knowing that the support wasn't there. But the fact is, our three mills weren't collecting enough revenue for the service. So that was one thing that the emergency manager did put in place, and It's some extra money for a lot of Flint residents, but now that fund can run without a deficit year after year, and that fee can be adjusted as necessary. And there are a lot of questions that come up in all this about the equity and who's paying the bill. And there are some things like the sanitation fee that I believe are fair, that each household needs to pay, you know, for its trash collection service. But I can tell you that there are things that I don't think are fair, too. And when you look at what the state has done with state shared revenues from sales taxes, they're now back at a 2003 revenue collection level, but they're, you know, providing local communities $800 million less than they did at that point in time. I think that's what Mayor Bing was getting to when he talked about the cuts in state shared revenue and the size of Detroit's annual deficit. And those are issues that end up getting decided in Lansing as opposed to here in Flint. So there has to be a reform of local government revenues, and I think you're seeing that from communities large and small, urban and rural. This property tax dependence doesn't work in a post-recession era.
Mayor, what do you hope that the year ahead will bring to Flint, and what are you hoping that you'll be able to tell the people of Flint in your State of the City speech in 2014?
Yeah, we need to have our deficit reduced. That $19 million is a huge burden to cost taxpayers, and we need for that to begin going down. That's one major effort. The other one is that we have to have this long-term master plan in place. We need to lay out where we're putting our public investments for the next 10 and 20 years and how those coordinate with the school district and the mass transportation, our public transit authority. All of that has to be coordinated. And then we need to show some progress with our crime-fighting efforts and with our economic development efforts. We need more people going to work. We need less people being victims of crime. And I believe we can make some progress on those. I'm actually optimistic about what 2013 can be for the city of Flint.
Flint Mayor Dane Walling, thanks for talking with us, as always, on Stateside.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come, Wikipedia seems to be gaining new respectability in the world of academia. We'll find out what this means for the way we gather information in the digital age. That's coming up in 15 minutes. This is Michigan Radio, and you're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan needs babies, and it needs the women who are willing to have them. That's the takeaway after demographer Kurt Metzger crunched the numbers and analyzed Michigan's birth rate. Just what's up with this anti-baby boom, and what might it mean for us as a state? Kurt Metzger is the director, of course, of Data Driven Detroit, and he joins us now from his office in Detroit. Hi, Kurt.
Hi there. How are you, Cynthia?
Good. So just how big is the drop in the number of babies being born in Michigan? How far back are you going?
Well, I went back just looking at the most recent period from 1990, because 1990 was the most recent high number after the baby boom years. 1990 was a big year for Michigan, and we have seen basically things dropping since then. It's about 25% drop in Michigan births since that period of time. In Detroit, we've seen a 55% drop in births.
In fact, I did see something that you had said, kind of to put it into perspective, this is about as low as it was during the World War II years.
Back in the mid-40s, right? It got as high as 195,000 births, and this was back in the right around 1960, toward the end of the baby boom, kind of the best years of the baby boom. And obviously the population in Michigan was a lot less than it is today, but we were down to 114,000 births in 2011, which is the most recent.
So what do you think is behind this decrease? What's behind the anti-baby boom?
The anti-baby boom. Well, a couple things. I mean, one piece of it is that birth rates have been going down primarily because some people attribute it to the economic recession, that people decided to kind of postpone births at that period of time just because of economic reasons. But also, we've been seeing this go down for women overall, with the exception of women in their late 30s, early 40s. And I think a lot of that is attributable to women getting an education, women going into the labor force, women wanting to have careers, and either delaying childbirth because we still as a country have not really come around to parental leave and some of the other issues to allow women to have children and have a career. So a lot of women have been forced to kind of put that off. And many women have decided to either have one or maybe no child. So a kind of a combination of women seeing birth rates going down because of that, but also economic reasons. And Michigan has the added benefit or deficit of the fact that we just don't have that many women in their childbearing years. We're not retaining them. We're not attracting them. And because of that, the combination of birth rates going down and the fact that you have a smaller base to begin with is going to lead to fewer births overall.
So that kind of popular image of, say, young graduates packing up and leaving Michigan, they're taking their baby-making possibilities with them.
That's exactly right. Baby-making is going out to other states.
I've seen that in my own family, actually. Our grandson's in Chicago.
You hear that over and over again. And,
yeah.
And you have to realize that also Michigan has, I think the last I looked, the eighth lowest birth rate in the country. So we're right up there with the northeastern states, which tend to be older and tend to have lower birth rates. But Michigan is well beyond the curve. And we actually, if you look at the age structure of Michigan, we're aging faster than just about any state in the country. So this whole idea of births going down, but the fact is it really does tie into this idea of how do we get young creative people, many of whom aren't going to have children anyway. I mean, there is that
sure.
tendency not to, but at least it gives us a chance if we can get women in their childbearing years to come and stay in Michigan.
We're talking with Kurt Metzger, who's the director of Data Driven Detroit, about his findings, basically Michigan needing babies because the birth rate in our state has fallen to rates that last seen in the mid-1940s. Now, it does seem that there are certain patterns that you can see throughout Michigan. I got the feeling in reading your writing, Kurt, that the women of the Upper Peninsula are doing their bit.
Yes, I looked at numbers for the counties. So instead of just looking at statewide numbers, I checked every county and I looked at the average number of births between 2000 and 2001 compared to 2010-11, the most recent. And essentially, 79 out of 83 counties saw drops in terms of births. So we saw a pattern across the state that most counties saw drops, some very significant. But three counties in northern Michigan, of the four counties that actually saw growth, we saw Houghton and Marquette, and it could be tied to universities. Maybe some university students are having children, or maybe because we have some numbers that folks from the universities are staying in those areas. And we also saw Iron County, which is not one of those hotbeds of births. But the three counties in the Upper Peninsula actually saw growth, and one other, Wexford County, in just south of Grand Traverse,
yes,
saw births go up.
It may have
I
to
have
do
no
with...
no idea why.
Maybe colleges or maybe just long, cold winters. I don't know.
Well, it's kind of like rural Tennessee, right? What else do you do?
So, there you go.
But, you know, the numbers, obviously, we have a very small base to begin with, and,
sure.
and many of the counties up in the Upper Peninsula actually are seeing more people die than are being born. So, but it is good to see at least somewhere births are up.
Well, I guess, you know, I know we're kind of joking about long, cold winters, but getting a little serious, what do you see as the possible result for Michigan of this lower birth rate, both economically and then politically?
Well, what you do see, and I mean, it is beyond just the fact that we're not having children. I think you have to look at a number of the reasons behind that. And certainly you want, you know, births tend to show a vibrant economy, kind of a quality of life that people are seeing this as a place that they want to have children and raise families. But it points to this fact that Michigan is still, no matter what, having a difficult time retaining young people coming out of colleges or retaining people, period, in terms of younger age groups, and we're not attracting them. So how do we start to attract the younger people, get them to decide that once they get married, that they want to have a family and they want to stay in Michigan? I mean, this is, you know, we talk about we want young people with college degrees. Certainly we want that. And there's no reason not to get young people with college degrees and keep them here in the state and have them decide that they're going to raise their family here in the state. So it's all the issues of, again, how does Michigan restructure itself so that it starts to attract a younger population? And really the trends that we're seeing, if you have lower births and you see your population 55 and over growing tremendously, and your overall median age going up very quickly and actually doing it faster than other states across the country, that does not bode well when businesses are looking where to locate. They're looking for a younger educated workforce, but they're looking for a younger workforce. We also have to figure out, if we've got a higher percentage of elderly folks, how do we start paying the bills, and how do we kind of keep that economy driving, and how do we keep replenishing the population? We don't want, I mean, being a person who's over 55, I don't want people to look down on me, but at the same time, you have to have a base that's paying the bills for that older population.
Well, what we can say to all of our kids who are living in other states, come on home, grandma will babysit for you. So come home and have your babies here.
Exactly. Instead, many of those kids are asking grandma to come to them. So let's figure out how do we get them back here.
This grandma has done exactly that. I know the path to Chicago very well. Kurt Metzger, always a pleasure to talk with you. Kurt's the director of Data Driven Detroit. Thanks so much for talking with us, Kurt.
Bye-bye.
This is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, almost everybody who goes online and searches for some bit of information knows about Wikipedia. For a lot of us, it's a great way to answer trivia questions or those friendly arguments among friends over just about any topic. But this free online encyclopedia that anyone can edit has not been widely accepted in academia, largely because, well, it's a free encyclopedia that anyone can edit. But that seems to be changing. In recent years, Wikipedia is gaining some new respectability in the world of academia and cultural institutions, galleries, libraries, archives, museums. Why is this, and what might it mean in terms of bringing the treasures of those cultural institutions to a much wider audience? We're joined here in the studio by Professor Cliff Lampe of the School of Information at the University of Michigan. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And one of his grad students, Michael Barrera. Michael recently became the first Wikipedian in residence at the Gerald R. Ford Library. Welcome to you as well, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, Cliff, I want to start. I'm going to tell you, without a doubt, and I bet you hear this a lot, when my daughter was in high school just a very few short years ago, she was searching for some fact for a school project, and I said, well, did you check Wikipedia? Well, the reaction of horror, and it was very, very clear that her teachers had been extremely firm about steering clear and not using Wikipedia for any academic purpose. Is that a fairly typical teacher reaction and student reaction?
Very typical. I always ask my undergraduates how many of them were told never to use Wikipedia, and their hands shoot up, and every public talk I get, hands shoot up when they're asked about that. And
yeah.
people get a bad rap about Wikipedia. There are a few reasons for that, right? I think the narrative of it, of everybody can edit it, makes it feel like a public wall, right? Like
yes.
Where, you know, who knows what kind of graffiti is going to appear on it. And what they don't see are kind of all the invisible processes mm-hmm. behind it. There is this incredibly rich and complex mm-hmm. social structure behind mm-hmm. what goes up on Wikipedia. Hmm. And it becomes invisible because the only thing you see is the front page. But mm-hmm. if you dig just a little bit beneath the surface, you see that there's actually a huge amount of social structure that goes on to keep the content really high quality.
So this is not the equivalent of the public comments on some blog or
right,
something.
No, it's not a million monkeys typing randomly on keyboards, right? It's definitely passionate, intelligent people who are devoting major sections of their lives to curating this thing.
Well, Michael, you are the brand new and first ever Wikipedian in residence at the Gerald R. Ford Library. In fact, you're the first at any presidential library?
At a presidential library. Correct, yes.
So what does that mean? What do you do?
It essentially means that I work on editing Wikipedia on content that's thematically related to Gerald R. Ford on site at the library. I'm working with his life, his career, his presidency, pretty much the same scope that the library has, mm-hmm. but it's not an institution-focused job, really, because it's a content-focused job.
So, Cliff, what does the library get by having a Wikipedian in residence?
A couple of big things, I think. One is his expertise, right? So Michael is an expert Wikipedian, and it takes a little while to understand the social structure that I was talking about.
Yes. And most of us have no idea. It's the page that pops up where mm-hmm. you want to find out who's the actor in the old movie,
right,
or this, what issue or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. These folks have their own norms, their own language, their own ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. And so having having access to an expert like Michael jumpstarts the library. It allows them basically a native guide into the wild fields of Wikipedia. The other thing that they get is access to a wide audience, right? I think with any cultural institution, whether it be a library or a museum, one of the things they're always thinking about is how can we make our collection, which is awesome, they spent a lot of time and effort making a really strong collection, more widely available to people who want to have access to it. Well, you know, as much as people might say don't use Wikipedia, everybody does, right? And
right.
So putting things on Wikipedia provides access to so many more different audiences.
So we're really... Oh, you're opening a window and looking into the future of using Wikipedia in a way that is very, very serious. And what does it say, I guess, about having one of your students, Cliff, as a Wikipedian in residence at his presidential library? What does it say about programs like yours, about the School of Information, and what it could mean to a student just like Michael in terms of job prospects?
Well, Michael's expertise doesn't necessarily come from our school, right? He's been working as a Wikipedian for a long time, and we hope we provide him with a great basis in which to expand that knowledge. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we're dealing with a new set of literacies and a new set of skills that people haven't really seriously addressed before, right? So, you know, how do you be appropriately critical of a Wikipedia page? There are lots of ways to do that, but you have to have some training and some knowledge in order to do that. You know, how do you, if you take social media more broadly, how do you think critically about Twitter or Facebook or Pinterest? You know, how do you think about data mining and all these things and how they affect our lives? We just used an example in the school recently about how Target knows if you're pregnant before other people do, right? And so
when that dad started getting mailings about his baby products.
So it creates a whole set of opportunities for students to think and be thoughtful about how these new information systems really affect our society and our lives overall.
Michael, what do you say when people you know or students you've known through the years who would say, repeat, the teachers would say, they can never use Wikipedia? What should a student look for to know whether this information is good?
Well, I think you have to remember, you always have to be critical. Mm-hmm. You always have to be skeptical. You always have to think when you read anything. And that's true of everything, from Britannica to the Wall Street Journal to anything that's print or non-print media. And Wikipedia is no different. But there are a number of different ways that you can roughly gauge the quality of a Wikipedia article. The best one is to look for the references. If you look closely at a Wikipedia page, you'll notice little blue footnotes. Mm-hmm. And everything that's got a footnote is cited in the references section at the bottom of the article. And you can't always trust that. There was actually just a hoax that was uncovered a couple of weeks ago that essentially had all of these references, and they were to either books that didn't actually have that information in it or to fictitious books. So, books that had ISBN numbers that, well, didn't exist. So every once in a while, you'll come across a case where you can't trust a reference.
Okay.
But in the majority of the cases, the vast majority, you can. And most of the times, you can follow those references to web links off-site, so external links. So you can actually do the fact-checking yourself in most situations, which is really nice. But that's really the biggest way you can check a Wikipedia article. The other thing you can do is that Wikipedia has this whole system of article grading, really, for it's called articles by quality. And the top two, featured article and then good article, have little icons in the top right corner of the page. Featured articles have little bronze five-pointed stars.
Okay.
And good articles have little green plus icons. And they're both peer-reviewed by the Wikipedia community, so not traditional academic peer review, but reviewed by the community, and they have strict standards. Featured articles are the best of the best. Good articles are like one step down, kind of like silver medalists.
Yeah.
They don't have to be comprehensive the way that featured articles have to, but they still have really stringent standards. But, you know, I mean, the big thing is nothing on Wikipedia is perfect. Nothing ever will be perfect. If you know the logo, there's a reason that there are a few puzzle pieces missing from the logo. It's an unfinished project, and things will always be growing and maturing. But I think that we are seeing increasingly this threshold of quality being met by more and more articles across the board.
And Cliff, what is all of this, this increasing acceptance of Wikipedia, the fact that you have a presidential librarian deciding, or, you know, a presidential library deciding we need a Wikipedian in residence, What do you see as what that means for the way that we're going to be gathering and compiling information in the future, especially the global impact?
I mean, many people are now participating in places online where they're producing information, mm-hmm. right? Whether it be on a mommy blog or whether it be on Flickr or Instagram, we are now creating content and sharing it with others. Wikipedia was an early entrant in this, but it's not the only one. And so I do think that we're working in a world now where we are content producers and are going to have new forms of literacy again, where we think about how to do that in ways that are really compelling and really provide value to the world. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you talk to Wikipedians about, one of the things they're always very conscious of is Wikipedia makes the world better, right? Mm-hmm. And that they're dedicated to the project because it makes the world a better mm-hmm. place, because it puts information in people's hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's what it's all about.
It is indeed.
We've been talking with Michael Barrera, who's a grad student at the University of Michigan School of Information, but he is the newly named and first ever Wikipedian in residence at the Gerald R. Ford Library, and Professor Cliff Lampe with the School of Information at U of M. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, Republican State Representative Mike Calton has introduced a bill that would allow medical marijuana dispensaries in Michigan. But that's after the state Supreme Court ruled a 2008 law does not allow dispensaries. We'll speak with Calton about his legislation coming up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's here. In just a few minutes, the state will release the results of its emergency review into Detroit's finances. Since late last year, a 6-member team has taken what's been called a deep dive into the city's records, trying to figure out just how massive Detroit's money troubles are. Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta joins us now. Rick, what are we expecting to hear in this report that's coming out?
Yeah, we're still waiting to get our hands on it, but what's in it is what we expect to find in it is pretty common knowledge, that there are big financial problems, both in terms of short-term cash flow, which could come to a head this summer, and the state could the city could literally run out of money to pay its bills, but also long-term debt problems in terms of pensions and things like that. I've heard the number $14 billion in long-term debt, and that despite a 10-month-old consent agreement between the state and the city, that Mayor Bing and the city council just can't seem to be able to come together to come up with a plan to dig out from those problems, which means that the city is in a financial crisis with no workable plan to get out of it. That's one of three determinations that this review team could have come to, that there is no financial crisis, that there is a fiscal problem, but that the city has a plan to get out of it, or that there is a financial crisis and the city has no plan to get out of it, that this would be the last of those three.
Yes. And does that review team offer suggestions for action, Rick, or does it just present the facts and let the governor take action from there?
Yeah, that's not really the review team's job, but once you make that last recommendation, it's only for one purpose, which is to clear the way for the governor to name an emergency financial manager. And we should point out that this gets a little confusing, because we had the emergency manager law,
right,
that was repealed by voters last year. The state then reverted to the older emergency financial manager law. That's the process that's in play right now, that mm-hmm. this person that the governor would name would be an emergency financial manager. However, at the end of March, there is a new emergency manager law. It replaces the one that was repealed in the referendum last year, and that would give emergency managers, once again, a lot of those powers that they have. Now, if it comes to an emergency manager, which the governor, first of all, the governor would have to accept these results,
mm-hmm.
that the city would then have 10 days, and the state has to wait 10 days to ask the governor to reconsider that decision. And if the city does that, then the governor owes the city officials a hearing. And then the governor can either revoke his earlier finding or he can affirm it. after that, then it's up to a state panel that, like this review team, is led by the state treasurer to actually hire someone to act as an emergency financial manager. And that emergency financial manager could do some things, could not do other things, but it would not have to wait for the new law if there was a swift determination made that that person just wanted to take the city right to federal bankruptcy court.
So that could be a decision that that person would make.
Mm-hmm. But I say you wouldn't have to wait for the new law to take effect.
Plunge right in
at the end of March. That there'll probably be an EFM named within a couple weeks of that law waiting to take effect. But there are things that that person could do without waiting for the new law.
Rick Pluta, are you hearing names as possible contenders for that job? Because I'm sure there were many who would argue it's a titanic job, probably largely a thankless, difficult job. And is it true that some people whose names have been mentioned are very quick to say, oh, no, thanks, I'm fine where I am?
We've heard more about the people who have apparently said no than anyone who would actually take it. I mean, not only does it and the name is escaping me at the moment, but the emergency manager of the Washington D.C. schools, I think was asked and has been turned down.
Mm-hmm.
But that this person would have to, you know, not only understand finance, municipal finance, that they would also have to have crisis management skills. They would have to have monumental political skills when you would look at all the parties that they would, you know, somehow have to bring together, especially after doing some really, really, really tough medicine to get the city's finances in order, that then they would have to bind the city, heal those wounds, and prepare it to move out of emergency management. That's a skill set that I would submit is probably held by very few people.
You know, it is soon to tell, but if the governor does indeed appoint an emergency manager, this would be making history across the country with the size of the city. What do you think the consequences might be for him, politically speaking?
Well, you know, you don't know, and for a politician, a decision like this, one of the biggest factors is just that like you said, that this is bigger than anything we've faced in terms of state takeovers of local government. Really, the closest thing might be the takeover of the Detroit public schools, and you'll remember back mm-hmm. in 1999 just what a ferocious controversy that was, that you literally had people coming in buses from Detroit and coming into the Capitol and overwhelming legislative committee meetings and things like that, that this would be a controversy on a level with that potentially. So you don't really know what the ramifications are, except for this one, Cindy,
mm-hmm.
which is once you order the takeover, if you're Governor Snyder, you now own it. It's yours, that you've got to fix the problem. And if you fix it, then the success is yours. But if the emergency manager doesn't fix it, then the failure is yours.
Hey, Rick, is there any sense that getting this presumably awful, terrible report card could lead to any better sense of cooperation between Mayor Bing and Detroit City Council?
Well, I guess, you know, the question that would raise for me is, I mean, if being forced into a consent agreement wasn't enough to get the mayor and the city council to cooperate, if the prospect of this for, you know, weeks and weeks, if not months, was not enough to get the mayor and the city council to cooperate toward coming up with something, why? How would this really change the dynamic? I mean, I think that what this report will, if it is what we all anticipate it will be, you know, what this report will say is that there really isn't any mechanism or any prospects for that to happen, which is why it would, you know, essentially recommend going ahead with a state takeover.
And it makes you kind of wonder what impact it might have if there is an emergency manager in place. What impact that might be have in people lining up to say, hey, I want to run for mayor of Detroit, people like Mike Duggan or Lisa Howes, those names, very clear whether Dave Bing would want to run again. There might be just a sense of why try?
Well, there would be the sense of why try, and the answer might be that, you know, with any luck, you could, you know, get, I don't know if a quick rinse bankruptcy like what we saw for the auto companies would be in the offing, but if it could be done, you know, fairly quickly, then you could conceivably be mayor on the other end of a state takeover when the city's emerging from it. But certainly, you know, that you will have people running for mayor, some of them running against emergency management, some of them running as practical candidates, saying that emergency management is a reality and we've got to work with it. That's actually what we saw over in Flint with Mayor Dane Walling, who now says that he wants to make Flint the model of how a large urban center should emerge from emergency management.
So drink that nasty-tasting medicine and then hopefully recover and move on.
Well, if it's inevitable, then you work with the circumstances that you're presented with.
Rick Pluta is Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, Rick, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Cindy.
It was earlier this month when the state Supreme Court handed out a ruling that's being interpreted as making medical marijuana dispensaries illegal. That February 8th ruling has marijuana users and the dispensaries essentially going underground, having to rely on word of mouth, dispensaries closing. Well, now comes a new chapter in Michigan's medical marijuana story. State Representative Mike Kelton, a Republican from Nashville in southwest Michigan, is sponsoring a bill to let local communities decide whether or not to allow medical marijuana dispensaries and where. His House Bill 4271 is being called the Dispensing Bill. State Rep. Mike Kelton joins us now. Representative Kelton, there was a similar bill that died last year in committee. Why are you taking this up again?
Well, last year I was a freshman and learned quite a bit about how to do this and think I've learned how we can advocate better for this bill. It was put in much too late. The committee was already overloaded. There were elections, and it never got a hearing. So now it's a new session. We're putting the bill in right away, and I've talked to the committee chairman, and I expect to get a hearing soon.
And you've got upfront Republican support. You've got 8 Republicans on board and 8 Democrats. So why do you think you're seeing growing support from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle?
You know, it is amazing. Last year, when I first had this bill, it was all I could do to get 2 co-sponsors. But this time, people were approaching me and wanted to get on board. 8 Republicans, 8 Dems, ranging from the most liberal to the most conservative, believe it or not. And I think attitudes have changed in the year. I think people have had discussions about it. They've had relatives or friends that maybe needed medical marijuana and saw how it helped them. And I can see right now this issue is moving a lot easier.
So personal experience made such a difference. Is that what is behind your support? Am I correct that you were originally against the Medical Marijuana Act?
I voted against it.
Yeah. So what made you change your mind?
Well, I am a chiropractor. And you know, for 24 years, I take care of people. And my father was an osteopathic doctor. And my grandfather was a medical doctor. And that's what we do in my family. We take care of people. And I think there was a moment where a light bulb went off in my head. A patient of mine came in, and he said, "Doc, I'm dying of cancer, of liver cancer." And he picked up his shirt, and under the bottom of his right rib cage, you could see the protrusion coming from under his ribs. And he said, and he looked terrible, and he said he lost a lot of weight, and I could see that. And he said he wasn't able to handle the medicines. He wasn't tolerating the medicines for appetite and for nausea. And he said he begged his doctor, and finally his doctor wrote him a recommendation for medical marijuana. And he said it was really helping, that it was getting rid of the nausea, increasing his appetite, keeping his weight on, and giving him some quality of life. That patient encounter really set me aback and really got me thinking. And it took a couple of weeks, but suddenly, you know, a light bulb went off in my head. I want to tell you about an encounter I had yesterday in my chiropractic office. I was adjusting a patient, and she was knew I had the bill and told me about a friend of hers that is dying, and she's bedridden. And she said that with the Supreme Court ruling, the dispensary closed, and she does not know what to do, the dying woman. She's under 100 pounds, probably in the upper 80s right now, in terms of weight. There's just nothing to her. They can't even get her to even take medicine that she's taking. But the marijuana, the medical marijuana, was giving her any kind of appetite she had. So now there's no dispensaries. Well, she's not going to grow it herself. She's too weak.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, in the 4 to 6 months it takes for that plant to be ready, she will be dead. And she doesn't know where to find a caregiver. There aren't enough caregivers.
And caregivers, and, I should say, that term is kind of used in general for the people who dispense the medical marijuana.
A caregiver can have up to 5 patients that they take care of.
Okay.
But they really can't mix people's marijuana, so that caregiver would have to have 4 to 6 months to grow that plant, and she's going to be dead.
Hmm.
And so, in my mind, I think that that patient has the right. If she's got a recommendation for medical marijuana, she's got the right to try to live. She's got the right to a certain quality of life, and she's got the right to go to what I call a provisionary center, not dispensary. I think she has the right to get her medicine today that she needs to stay alive.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking with State Representative Mike Calton, a Republican from Nashville, and he is sponsoring a bill to let local communities decide whether to allow medical marijuana dispensaries. That House Bill 4271, it's being called the Dispensing Bill. Now, I have to ask you, because I know that your bill is almost certainly going to get opposition from the state attorney general's office. They're saying, we think we're just fine. We don't need any new legislation to regulate medical marijuana. Do you feel there's a lack of empathy in that stand?
The attorney general's office, they're attorneys, and they work with law enforcement. And they look at this as a legal issue, as a law enforcement issue, perhaps as a criminal issue. But as a chiropractor, and my father was a doctor, and my grandfather was a doctor, we take care of people. And I look at this as a health care delivery issue.
And I want to address the concerns that we have heard from, let's say, sheriffs and law enforcement, who worry that these dispensaries present a, I don't know, pretty juicy opportunity to game the law, that you'll see patients with legitimate medical needs, like the patients you've told us about, getting their marijuana legally, and then at the same time, they worry the dispensaries might be selling some out the back door to dealers. What do you say to them?
I don't think so much it's that they're selling out the back door to dealers. That's not what they're doing. You are seeing some patients that I don't think are valid patients, where they are actually recreational users. I agree, that does happen. But I am not going to damn the patients that need this just to stop the recreational user from getting it. What is the worst thing that can happen? If someone gets it recreationally, they're going to get it anyway, but instead they're going to get stuff that's probably tested and in a safe place. I don't see that as a big negative. I say let's take care of the people that really need it. Now, I've talked to some people in law enforcement, and they're like, well, there's some people getting it that shouldn't, so let's shut down the whole thing. I just think that's wrong.
Representative Calton, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
State Representative Mike Calton is a Republican from Nashville in Southwest Michigan and sponsor of House Bill 4271 that would let residents or local officials decide if they wish to allow medical marijuana dispensaries to operate in their communities. And now a quick note on a story we've been following here on Stateside. Beginning today, certain undocumented immigrants living in Michigan will be able to get driver's licenses and state IDs. You may recall earlier this month, Republican Secretary of State Ruth Johnson reversed her position and said, yes, immigrants who are brought to the United States as children and are eligible for temporary federal work permits can get licenses. It's estimated there are about 15,000 people here in Michigan eligible for the program. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered today by Peg Watson. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.